It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. More than 10,000 Americans died of heroin overdose in 2014. From 2001 to 2014, there was a six-fold increase in the total number of deaths due to heroin. And Iowa is not going against the national trend. A similar spike here in the state in opioid-related deaths. Officials say emergency room visits here in Iowa related to opioid overdose have increased more than 200% over the last 10 years. Drug overdose deaths here in our state more than tripling during that time. Now, though, Iowans with family members who are addicted to heroin or narcotic painkillers have an easy way to acquire a potentially life-saving antidote. This comes after action by the medical director of the Iowa Department of Public Health. Patricia Quinlisk has issued a standing order so that any family member who demonstrates a need can go to a local pharmacy and purchase naloxone, otherwise known as Narcan, which can reverse the effects of an overdose. Now, Iowa is the 18th state to expand access to this drug through pharmacists. Joining us to talk about this change, Kim Brown is with us, a resident nurse, president and co-founder of QC Harm Reduction. It's a nonprofit dedicated to overdose awareness and prevention. And Kim Brown has been on this program before last year during the heroin summit. She described how her son, Andy, died from an accidental heroin overdose in May 2011. Kim Brown, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you, Ben.
Kevin Techow is with us, United States Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Kevin Techow, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Let's get a reaction here, first of all, before we get into it a little bit more. Kim, we spoke at the Heroin Summit. You were have been advocating for this change and other changes. Tell us what it means to you that this change has been made in the law here in Iowa.
Well, Ben, naturally, I'm very happy that we got our bill passed last April and that we have a standing order for pharmacists. That's good news. I think we have a lot more work to do regarding stocking our pharmacies and the cost that will be associated with purchasing naloxone for those who may not be able to afford it.
Mm-hmm. So what do you see there as the hurdles? This is a good initial step, but you're saying it's not making it accessible enough to those who need it?
Well, as we know from the surveys and the data that we get from other harm reductionists, in North Carolina, are actually a CDC report, 82.8% of reported reversals are carried out by people who actually use drugs and their friends, 9.6% by family, and 2% by public service providers. So my mission, of course, is to make sure that we get naloxone into the hands of those who are truly going to be saving lives.
Mm-hmm. And I know this, all your work here, your efforts, Kim, have been propelled by the tragedy of losing your son, Andy. I'm very sorry for that loss of yours and your family's. Can you recount how your son Andy became addicted to opiates and how he came to die from a heroin overdose, perhaps preventable by a law like this, a change?
Oh, absolutely. I think making naloxone widely or more readily available, which I still think Iowa has a way to go with readily available, but I do believe that it could have made a difference for my son because when he died, he was not alone. Meaning that those people that were with him or that person that was with him, had they had the knowledge and the access to the overdose reversal drug, may have been able to use it. But that was in 2011 when we did not have the awareness we have today.
Mm-hmm. And to give us a little context here, Kim, those with someone using heroin would be in danger of being prosecuted according to the sort of conventional ways and would have hesitancy, to say the least, to report it.
Right. And you know, that brings up another point, is that we have the Obama administration, we have the CDC, we have SAMHSA, we have everybody finally on board with science saying that problematic opioid use or substance use disorders are a brain disease or a brain disorder, and it should be moved into public health. Well, if we're going to move it into public health, then we shouldn't be arresting people that are putting a drug into their own body. We wouldn't treat a diabetic or somebody that perhaps had heart disease in that manner. So we got work to do.
Kevin Techcomb, United States Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa. Give us your reaction to this change in Iowa's law.
It's a great change. I commend Kim and her heartfelt passion for this effort. There's no doubt it's going to save lives in Iowa as it has in other states.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the mindset change that needs to accompany this change in law, Kevin, in order to make it effective. You can't just flip it on like a light switch and have it begin to save lives, or is that the case?
No, that's a great point. I think we're right at the starting line of introducing this remedy in the state of Iowa. Our most important responsibility at the U.S. Attorney's Office, Department of Justice, is keeping the public safe, whether that's from terrorism, violent crime, or drug overdoses. Definitely a tipping point across the United States when more Americans are dying now from drug overdose than they are from traffic crashes. And so we're really focused in on evidence-based, intel-led policing, but we're not going to prosecute our way out of this problem. So we know from other states, other jurisdictions, prevention is the key to getting out in front of this issue, and the Narcan is one tool in the toolbox that's going to help us do that.
Kevin, I know one initiative you've been involved in is a series of town hall meetings across the state. Tell us about those meetings and who they're meant for in particular.
The first one we did was the one you mentioned that we did with our partners at the Injury Prevention Center and the College of Public Health. That one was aimed at multidisciplinary medical, community health, and law enforcement. We've also held meetings at the Drake University College of Pharmacy, also aimed at medical groups and other professionals. But we've done a number of town halls for everyday citizens to get the word out of the dangers of this problem. It doesn't matter how big a house you live in, how thick your wallet is. This is a problem that reaches across all demographics, across all ages in the United States. And so those town halls are really aimed at getting the word out on prevention and issue awareness so we can see the signs of this and so we can get out ahead of it better than we are today.
Kevin, as the United States Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa, you've had a good vantage point to watch the spread of opioid use and the epidemic across the country and across our state. What areas in Iowa are hardest hit? How does it spread? Is it equal throughout the state or urban centers? Or
it's more predominant in the eastern part of the state, here in Johnson County, Scott County, Black Hawk, Lynn, and Dubuque account for some 60% of the overdose and then the heroin deaths. But there is a spike in Polk County, and then we're starting to see it in the other more urban counties. But we have an office in Sioux City. We're not seeing much of it yet. But that's an advantage that we have, that we can learn lessons from other states, New England states, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and Ohio, so we can get out ahead of this and prevent the epidemic portions that they're seeing today.
Mm-hmm. Lessons learned from states that encountered this to a much greater degree before we did here in Iowa. What lessons in particular are you paying attention to?
Well, the gateway to many of these overdose deaths is the overprescription of opioids. And so we know that if we can do a better job of reducing the unnecessary prescription of opioids, as well as getting unnecessary drugs out of people's cabinets and other such measures and issue awareness, we can prevent more people from getting in a position where they do become addicted.
Mm-hmm. Getting, for instance, you have a fall, you break your arm, you're perhaps prescribed some opioids for the pain. You don't need them all. What should happen to that, Kevin?
Well, as Kim alluded to, the CDC has actually issued new guidance for the medical community. So I think you see a general awareness in the medical community of the dangers of overprescription. On the prevention side, the Drug Enforcement Agency has done this for a number of years. But just to give you an idea of how big an issue this is, they do a drug back period in the fall and then in the spring. This last year, some 8 tons of drugs were turned in Iowa. And then we're working with the governor's Office of Drug Control Policy to make sure there's those opportunities every day in all 99 counties. And that's just about happened. So here in Johnson County, Lynn County, and others, every day people can go to their local law enforcement and drop unnecessary drugs into a box without any repercussions, and that's definitely a strong prevention measure.
Mm-hmm. Kim Brown, talk a little bit about opioid addiction, because you fought this tried to help your son for many years. It may be something that you at first seem is harmless. You're prescribed an opioid, and it makes you feel a lot better because you're in pain for whatever reason. But then it gets its tentacles around you, doesn't it?
I want to be careful when we talk about that, Ben, because, of course, I would not argue the fact that there are those who are prescribed a prescription opiate and end up with a problematic use. But by and large, most of the problems with the prescribed prescription pain medications are diversions. Most folks that are prescribed the medication and use it according to their doctor's directions are not the ones that go on to develop problematic use.
So diversion, you mean somebody else getting into the medicine,
right,
medicine cabinet, some member,
right,
of the family or something?
Mm-hmm. Right. To add to Kevin's point, I think being able to remove as many of those unused pills is probably a good step. But we don't want to overreach with this prescription pain pill issue, because we do have folks that rely on them for pain every day, and we don't want to, throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, we want to make sure that people's needs are being met and physicians aren't afraid to address pain patients' issues and needs.
Kevin Tackaw, tell us about some of the resistance to this change that has been encountered, and certainly well-meaning arguments here as well. It's not an easy situation, is it?
No, just like anything, there needs to be a balance. But some of the arguments that were given for not going in this direction were that it was basically an enabler, that it just lets people that are addicted to continue to be addicted because they know they have the safety valve. But I would strongly argue against that point. We know in jurisdictions that have had the Narcan for a while that it has led sharply to the number of overdose deaths.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us any numbers on that across
Montgomery
the nation?
Yeah, Montgomery County, which is Dayton, Ohio, while their overdose in and of themselves were not reduced last calendar year, the number of overdose deaths went down some 60 to 70%.
Mm-hmm. Kim, are you convinced that because of this change in law that lives will be saved here in Iowa?
I really am, and I think we need to take it a step further. I think that we need harm reduction organizations such as myself in every community in Iowa that have third-party standing orders in their communities so that they can train and dispense naloxone to the folks where it's going to really make a difference and reduce the cost prohibition that they're going to encounter when they walk into a drugstore, either with a prescription or to the pharmacist. So I think we have work to do, but yes, I do think that it's we're going to save lives.
Mm-hmm. What does naloxone cost enough of a dose to prevent an overdose?
Well, I did some calling probably about a month and a half, 2 months ago, to most pharmacies in my area, didn't even stock it. One pharmacy told me the corporate office was not encouraging them to stop, so it's like an order on demand. The prices that I encountered, they varied a bit. One pharmacy was $30 for 2 mils, or $30 for 2 doses of naloxone. And then we went up to $55. In between 30, maybe 60, and then if you run into, if you want to use the nasal spray, it's going to cost you more. I just purchased some, and it cost me, I think, almost $80 for 2 doses.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, is that also a problem that while you can change the law, you can't make pharmacies carry naloxone? So the awareness raising needs to happen as well.
Yeah, it's my understanding that the big pharmacy chains in the states, Massachusetts and other New England states, this has become very much available, very readily available. And so, in Dubuque County is out ahead of this. Some of the medical groups up there in the hospitals have actually been doing training for the community because they had a tragic situation this past spring where 2 brothers died of an overdose on the same night. So a lot of issue awareness, I think, as people understand the dynamics and how easy this is to prevent a death, you're going to see more and more of it across Iowa.
Kevin Tackaw, United States Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa, thanks for coming into our Iowa City studio.
Thank you. Appreciate the chance.
Kim Brown, thank you for joining us, president and co-founder of QC Harm Reduction. Kim, thank you again for joining us and keeping us up to date on the opioid epidemic and efforts at prevention.
Thank you, Ben. You have a good afternoon.
You too.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, we'll discuss the situation in the Middle East and the challenges that Donald Trump will face in that volatile region as president. My guest is Steve Grand, Executive Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the nonpartisan think tank, the Atlantic Council. Grand will speak tomorrow, Tuesday, before the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. Steve Grand, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure.
The Atlantic Council has a new report on the Middle East, just released as a result of a two-year study chaired by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She was Secretary of State under President Clinton. Also, a former National Security Advisor and head of the National Security Council, Stephen Hadley. He worked under President George W. Bush. This was a report to focus on ways to achieve stability and growth in the Middle East. What were the main findings?
Our main findings were, I think the headline was that there's a lot more to work with in the region than we expected when we set out on this. Everyone's familiar with the violence and the sectarianism and the extremism that has dominated at least the headlines about the region for quite some time. But we also found another narrative, which is that there are a tremendous number of people, particularly young people and women, who are taking the future into their own hands and are empowered, are educated, are connected to the world, and are trying to change their own lives, change their own communities, in some cases change their own countries. And so we saw these green shoots of change, which we think offer some real promise for the future. And one of the things we were also encouraged by is we think that some of governments are seeing and recognizing both the potential and the power that these young people, that women, that entrepreneurial folk have, and how much they can contribute to positive change in the region. And some countries are beginning to take steps to enable that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what you just called the green shoots of change. Can you give us some examples? You mentioned young people, women. What specifically did your report find?
It's people who are engaged in their communities, who are not waiting for government to fix their problems, but banding together and trying to find local solutions to local problems. It's young, savvy entrepreneurs who are using new technologies to develop high-tech startups in many cases that have been quite successful and prosperous across the region. It's women in Egypt, for example, coming up with a program that crowdsources harassment and alerts police to instances, and women as well, to instances and places where harassment is taking place, so that women can be safer.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's those.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about the threats that you identified in this study.
Well, you know, on the negative side of the ledger, what's clearly been happening in the region is you have this more empowered citizenry who wants more, in part because of globalization and because of the internet and social media. They're able to compare much better than before what's happening in their countries versus that in other countries. And they're demanding more of governments. And some governments have governed quite badly over time in the region and corruptly. And citizens are not going to stand for that any longer. And so you have some instances where states have not only governed badly and not been able to meet the expectations of their citizens, but where states have actually failed. And you've seen in those cases of state failure, these civil wars emerge. And the civil wars are not really the cause of the region's problems, but they've been a major accelerant of the problems we see in the region. They've opened the door for ISIS and Al-Qaeda to come in. They have created heightened sectarian feeling between Sunnis and Shia in the region. They've created a lot of death and destruction, and they've created these tremendous refugee flows that have been so destabilizing to the region, but also to Europe, and even to the politics here in the United States.
The report says that, in the words of the report, to quote it, the days of external powers trying to orchestrate and even dictate political reality in the region, in the Middle East, are finished. I wonder if the report identified a turning point, the events that convince you at the Atlantic Council that this is the case, that there is a different set of circumstances there now that the U.S. has to deal with.
Yeah, we really think we propose a new strategic approach to the region that's more one of partnership rather than a great power sort of telling people in the region what to do. For many years, the Europeans tried that, and we probably are guilty of it coming after them in doing the same. And I don't think that ever quite worked very well, and it's certainly not appropriate to the moment today. Arab people in particular are really determined to create their own destiny. And what we heard often as we traveled through the region from leaders and from publics were phrases like, we're ready, we're shaping a vision, let us lead. That doesn't mean that they don't need help, help in particular in ending these violent civil wars and in tamping down the sectarianism that's become such a problem in the region. But they are determined to forge a new kind of Middle East. People, I think, to get to your question, I think because of the internet, because of globalization, because of education, higher education levels, are much more prepared to take their own futures in their hands. And governments seem to be waking up in the region to that. So there's a certain political moment there right now where we feel a different kind of approach to the region might just lead to something far better than what we've seen in recent years.
A different approach, a help. That is the tricky part here, really, isn't it? What is the nature of that help? What should be the nature of that help so that it actually does facilitate an evolution of these countries into a better place and not be interpreted as a sort of a neo-colonial involvement, right?
Right. Well, you know, we started out this project with great humility because this is a really complex challenge, and we listened a lot. And I think that's sort of the starting point where the United States should begin is by listening, by letting the region itself begin to shape a vision, begin to act on that vision, but making clear that we are willing to be there as a partner and supporting countries that are willing to take risks for change, and also in helping them address the violence and begin to wind down the violence that has been so destabilizing to the region. If you think about all these green shoots that I talked about, all this positive, useful energy and new activity that's going on in the region, none of that's going to be able to really spread and blossom in conditions of warfare and instability. There needs to be a certain minimum level of security and stability for the kinds of investments we think are important in human capital to take root.
If you've just joined us, Steve Grand is my guest this half hour, Executive Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the nonpartisan think tank, the Atlantic Council. Steve will be speaking. He's the guest speaker tomorrow, Tuesday, before the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. One of the tasks in this report, it took 2 years to research and put together, is to better deal with the problems of refugees. What is the answer? How does this report recommend attacking the unprecedented level of refugees?
Well, I think step one is recognizing that it's the civil wars that are creating these tremendous refugee flows. People are choosing to cross borders and seek refuge elsewhere because conditions at home are just so awful. And if we can wind down these civil wars, if we can find political settlements that are inclusive and that are just and that are enforceable over time, a lot of the impetus for people to flee will go away. Secondly, we came to recognize that refugees can be a great asset for the future. In war-troubled areas like Syria, these are the people at the end of the day who, under the right conditions, are going to come back and rebuild their communities and hopefully make them more tolerant, more vibrant, and more resilient over time. So there's an opportunity, if we invest in these refugees, to turn them into a positive force rather than the very negative image that many people have of refugees. We saw in many, many different instances that where in host countries like Jordan and Turkey and Lebanon, where these refugees have access to the labor markets, are able to work, have decent housing, they become over time contributing members of society. It also means that they're more likely, these kinds of people who've been integrated into their host societies are also the very people who are most likely to go back at the end of the day and participate in the rebuilding of their own societies when the violence subsides.
Let's talk a little bit about the incoming administration. In something like 7 weeks, Donald Trump will become president of the United States, succeeding Barack Obama. How do the findings of this report compare with what you've heard, what we've heard from the president-elect about what should be done in the Middle East?
Well, you know, I think it's early, so it's hard to say what this administration will do and how they will approach the Middle East. We did not write this study for one particular party or another. We recognize that either candidate could win the elections. But we think there's much in the report that's consistent with what President-elect Trump has said about the Middle East.
For instance?
He's talked about the importance of defeating Daesh, ISIS, and I think we show how you can embed that effort within a larger strategy that makes any battlefield victories sustainable over time. There's not really a military solution to the problem of ISIS or Al-Qaeda. It needs to be embedded in a larger strategy that leads to changes in the region and how it's governed and how leaders in the region act. Mm-hmm. So that many of the grievances that provide the ideological narrative behind Al-Qaeda and ISIS go away.
Is what the report is recommending as far as involvement in this area, and U.S. military involvement and otherwise, so much different than what Barack Obama has been doing the past few years?
It builds on it, but it does say we got to do more in certain areas, and certainly in going after and defeating Daesh, ISIS, as it's also known. We feel that there's a lot more that could be done and needs to be done, and that it needs to be embedded in the larger strategy of transformation that helps these societies build more legitimate, more effective, better governed states over time.
Mm-hmm. What are you seeing in Donald Trump's cabinet choices thus far regarding Middle East policy?
Well, it suggests some nominees who are keen to focus a great deal on ISIS and Al-Qaeda. It suggests a couple people who are keen to take a tougher line against Iran. And we talk a good bit in our report about how one, it needs to deter and contain Iran while at the same time looking for opportunities to engage it on issues of mutual interest. And it's an administration, or at least the president-elect, who's made clear that he thinks that our friends and allies should do more. And that's really been a premise of our strategy from the beginning, that our friends and allies in the Middle East are not only able but keen to do more, and a new kind of relationship is possible where we just enable and empower those in the region to create their own destiny.
Mm-hmm. Just hours ago, Donald Trump posted a series of tweets criticizing China for monetary policy, its operations in the South China Sea. And last week, Donald Trump risked a diplomatic rift with China by speaking directly with Taiwan's president. I wonder, what are your thoughts on this unusual style of diplomacy, tweeting, for example? Is it a new, possibly effective form of diplomacy, or is it more like a bull in a china shop?
I think it depends, and we just need to see. I don't think a new administration, I think, always has the right to and is smart to try to alter the carrots and sticks they present to some of our enemies and to some of our friends, and try to sort of tweak the relationship by getting a little bit of leverage. And, you know, maybe that's what he's doing with Taiwan vis-a-vis China. So I think it's perfectly legitimate and okay for a new president to try to come in and change some relationships and get a little bit more leverage in that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
What I think would be dangerous and destabilizing is to walk away from the international order that the U.S. has created beginning after World War II, and that has provided a framework for how states relate to one another, and has been tremendously important in keeping the world safe and peaceful and in enlarging economic prosperity across the globe. And that is an architecture that was difficult to construct and would be a disaster to destroy. It is essential to our success as a country, and it is important to the stability of the world.
Mm-hmm. But that diplomatic protocol that's been built up doesn't necessarily rule out tweeting as a form of diplomacy.
Not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. You know, a new administration needs to have a consistent, coherent message. And so one needs to make sure that what one tweets is consistent with policy. But I think every new president in recent era, or every president going back to Roosevelt with his radio speeches, his fireside radio speeches, has tried to find new ways to communicate with the American public. So I don't think we should be opposed to new forms of communication with citizens.
In talking about the Middle East and the many challenges there, what are the Atlantic Council's thoughts in this study on Russia's role in the Middle East?
Sure. You know, I think, and this ties back to our discussion of the new administration, the new administration seems to be trying to recalibrate relations with Russia. And maybe that presents an opportunity to have a different kind of conversation with Russia about the Middle East, and try to find some sort of understanding with Russia about these civil wars in particular. But I think we need the Russians to recognize that an unqualified embrace of Bashar al-Assad or other authoritarian leaders in the region is not the way that you get to stability, long-term stability in the region, and not the way you address the terrorist threats that the Middle East presents at the moment.
Before we finish up, we don't have much time left, Steve, but a quick word on the Atlantic Council's position on Iran, considering the new administration.
Well, the Atlantic Council as an organization doesn't take policy positions. In this particular project, in this task force, we look closely at Iran's role in the region. And like the incoming administration, found many of Iran's aggressive foreign policies in the region destabilizing. We think, and we write in the report, that the existing nuclear agreement is in place and is probably better than any alternative at the moment. So the key in moving forward is how do you enforce that agreement and ensure that Iran abides by all the terms while at the same time containing and deterring Iran's more aggressive foreign policy actions in the region. And we think one of the ways that you can do that is by being more forceful when it comes to Syria and pushing back on Russian and the Syrian government atrocities against civilians in Syria. We don't think the massive killing of civilians in Syria is helpful to resolving the conflict in Syria, and we think humanitarian protection should always come first, the defense of innocent civilians trapped in war zones.
Okay. Steve Grand, thank you very much. Executive Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the nonpartisan think tank, the Atlantic Council. Steve will be speaking tomorrow, Tuesday, before the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. Steve Grand, thanks for this conversation.
Thank you, Ben. Enjoyed it greatly.